Good evening, everyone, and welcome. All during COVID, we had lots of Zoom meetings, but this is one of the few live meetings we've had in the last few years, and it is much nicer to have everyone here. Such a pity that we're held up with things going on in the street, but I'm glad you all made it here, even if you had to climb all the machines to get to us. As I say, we did have quite a few meetings on Zoom during lockdown, and they are available on our website if you want to spend your time listening to what all the eminent speakers we've had have done. And tonight's meeting will eventually also be on our website, but not for a while. And of course, it's much nicer being here than just seeing a recording. So the format of this evening is that we have three speakers, and I'll introduce them in time. Each of them will speak for up to 15 minutes or so. And then after that, we can have questions. And I'm mentioning the questions now so that you can be thinking about what you might need or want to ask. And because it's an Oxford audience, I'm just going to emphasize that we want questions, not commentaries. Or life stories. Please just ask questions concisely, please. So, Brexit is a failed project, but a brighter future is possible. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. How are we going to do that? Well, we've got three speakers to tell us. And our first speaker this evening is Danny Dorling. He's very well known. He's local. He grew up in Oxford, went to school in East Oxford. He studied geography and started his career in Newcastle. And because he's a geographer, he's moved around a bit. That's what they do. Universities in England and in New Zealand. But he's now a professor of human geography here at the University of Oxford. His interests include housing, health, employment, education, and poverty. Well, everything, really. So he can talk to us about everything. Welcome, Danny.
Now we got some slides. I think I'm the only person doing slides. You're allowed to have good eyesight, but they're really a prop for me. I'm going to be quick through this, so definitely 15 minutes. The first one is John Major. And I'm going to talk a little bit about where did this come from and to remember. This is 1993, over 30 years ago, when he gave a statement, 50 years on from now, Britain will still be the country of long shadows on county grounds. Warm beer, invincible green suburbs, and so on and so on. Old maid cycling to Holy Communion. He was trying to reassure us about a particular change in our relationship with Europe, but he was also trying to deal with the knives in his back, for those who can remember. I won't say the words he used to describe them, but it's important to remember when you're trying to explain to people what happened. Remember, somebody like me has to explain to 18 or 19-year-olds what happened. It's a long history. Let's click forward quickly, because really I just want to show you two graphs at the end of this, but being a lecturer, I have too many slides. Margaret Thatcher and
Tony Blair.
You can't read the text. Margaret was very pro. She was pro-joining, if you remember that jumper with all the flags and so on. Tony very pro, but I would argue in a way both of them helped sow the seeds for what occurred. Let's go forward to our first graph. This is inequality coming up now. It should be red and blue as a delay on coming forward. A huge rise in inequality. We went from being the second most equal country in Europe to Sweden, large country, to overtaking Portugal and becoming the most unequal country in Western Europe, and then the most unequal divided country in all of Europe other than Bulgaria. You know, these are the antecedents of Brexit. If you wonder why us, To give you some positive, maybe not positive, you may not think it is, it was going to be somebody. A country was going to leave the EU because it's a democracy, it's a democratic body, you don't have to stay in. We helped prove it was. And if you're trying to say, well, why us? Well, we'd gone through a hell of a shock. That shock meant that you couldn't get a well-paid job anymore. You can't have that level of inequality and get well-paid jobs for most people. You can't get a house. You can't start a family. Things fall apart. If you like inequality, and there are people in this country who like inequality, you tell people, oh, it's due to the immigrants. It's due to those European bureaucrats. It's that's why. If we just were free of all of that, we would be great again. Let's click forward again, and we have to realise we were strange and we were odd. This is spending, my most complicated graph, but with a red line at the bottom. Public spending as a proportion of GDP. Greece, shortly after the generals, was worse than us. Spain, after Franco, but essentially we're a low-tax, low-spend economy. If you're thinking about why us, that'll do. Don't worry, you get the idea. And this is the positive side, I'll give you. If it hadn't been us, it would have been somewhere like Greece. And it would have been worse for them. Right? Because it's already a country which was in dire straits following the banking crash. It has a land border with Europe, with Bulgaria. Every country in Europe now knows that if you've got a land border, you don't think about leaving. In fact, they don't think about leaving. All the far-right parties of Europe may still be far-right, but they don't talk about leaving anymore. Right? We've done a favour. Not good for us, but it hasn't damaged them very much. Or I'll try and give you one more positive thing. Imagine that I was a Remainer. Imagine we'd won 52% Remain, 48% Leave. What would have happened? Well, that's what the spread betting said. That was what they expected. That's what the Leave campaign thought was going to happen. They thought they were going to narrowly lose. That's why they did a series of things which were illegal, because they didn't think they were going to be investigated. You wouldn't do those things. Otherwise, if you can remember the shock on Boris Johnson and Michael Gove's face the day after, right? They didn't expect to win. What they were getting ready for was a long, protracted war of attrition, the call for a second referendum. We would be a country still in civil war if we hadn't voted Leave. I'm not saying it's a good thing, I'm just trying to say we didn't realise what a mess we were in. We really didn't see it. Let's click forward again, just about six more slides. This one is just from a friend of mine who's an artist. What she's done is print out all the regulations for universal benefit onto a piece of silk to see how long it is that you have to read if you want to claim Europe's most miserly benefits. And she's done this for several sets of government regulations. It's not necessarily a country to be terribly proud of compared to what the mainland had. And there was a fear amongst those who funded Brexit, those who wanted it, who were based in hedge fund offices in Mayfair, which allowed Nigel Farage to have free accommodation, or who ran chains of pubs, or whose fathers were colonial officers in Belize and so on. I mean, you remember who actually did this. Let's click forward on what we're good at. We're good at three things. We're good at banking, particularly casino banking. We are world leader in gambling. This isn't per capita, this is absolute that we're good at. And you can see Singapore 2.0, the idea of being offshore. Let's click forward again, because I have five more slides we need to get through. Another one, do fast. We're number one in the world for the highest university fees. It's an export earner. Although the Mini car factory at a Mini every minute and 2 seconds makes more money in export earnings than this university does, producing an overseas PhD student in about 4 years. Sadly, those profits from the Mini go to Germany. But at least BMW are still here, following a £75 million bribe and the cutting of £250 million Social Security benefit cut that day, because the international bankers would not tolerate us handing £75 million to BMW to keep it in Oxford if we didn't cut. If you remember Liz Truss' wonderful 49 days, you know, all these things. Let's click forward again. This is the Times. I'll do a kind of curse on all your houses. I think this is Starmer saying, we agree we can charge the highest university fees in the world. It'll be fine. There is a continent which we are a part of where they don't charge fees, where they teach each other's children very well, and where amazing things happen. Children go to school without wearing a uniform, and there aren't riots. I mean, there's all kinds of things we can learn from this strange place. It's a long way away. It's 20 miles across the channel. Right. Oh, good. Stop there. This is the one I want to talk about. And 4 minutes and I'll be over. Do you remember David Cameron saying he was going to make us all happy and telling the ONS that they had to introduce a measure of happiness? Okay. ONS did it. It's when he hugged a husky, when he wore a hoodie, when he flew to see Nelson Mandela very, very quickly. I won't tell you why he did that, but you can guess. They did it. And there are several measures. I'm going to show you anxiety, and then I'm going to show you the other three. Now, what was amazing is they don't really care about statistics. And this thing got better. Anxiety actually went down under Cameron. It went down because we were retreating, getting away from the 2008 banking crisis, which was very, very scary. Things were looking better. There was a coalition government. Most people had voted Liberal or Conservative. The fear of the country falling apart was down. Then even when they announced we're going to have a referendum in 2015, anxiety levels didn't go up. It carried on pretty stable, but then began to rise dramatically. Now, the blue line is at the very first point when the first person died in Wuhan. And the point of showing this is that the orange line goes up before that. Let's click forward to the measure where you ask people by ONS, are things worthwhile in life? How satisfied are you of life? How happy you are? We've only got one more after this. And again, you can see David Cameron never checked. He could have said, look at what I've done. I've made you happier. It goes up and down in the summer and winter. And it carried on getting happier 2018, 2019. Why on earth are people happy 2018, 2019? Well, 52% had got or thought they were going to get what they voted for. The other 48% of those who voted thought it was going to be reversed. I mean, that's what a normal European country does if people did the wrong thing. There were 500,000 members, new members of the political party I like, who were getting something they liked very, very much and had an incredible election in 2017. There were a lot of happy people in those months of proroguing of Parliament and terrible things going on when we measure it. What is absolutely shocking is that in June, July, August, September and October, those levels of satisfaction with life, happiness, plummeted. Anxiety, the one we just went up to a peak, it's never been measured before, culminating in the election of December 2019, the most traumatic event in the history of Britain, as measured since the Second World War. Now, the anxiety one shows it. These don't quite. With anxiety, COVID was less fear-making than Boris Johnson's landslide election by the ONS measure. Wave 2, which came in January 2021, was actually slightly worse. Wave 2 was the, oh no, this isn't going to go away, even though we've got a vaccine. But my point, and I've got 1 minute left, is that there was no celebration. All those people who voted for that landslide election were not happy. If they had been happy, they should have cancelled out the unhappiness of the others. The get it done thing, and we can look at it in more and more detail, it really was a just get over this. It wasn't a celebration. Now, then we get a pandemic, so it's quite hard to tell, but everything has fallen apart. My last slide. I did a report last year, quite long, where I was asked by a think tank based in Germany to go through what the pluses and minuses of Brexit had been. try and do a balanced account. The report is very long because I kept on going. There are no positives whatsoever. Happy to argue with you. I really can't find a single thing that has got better, other than we've saved another European country from doing this. We have proved that the EU is a democratic union, and at least we've probably sped the process ahead for ourselves. I think it would have been slower had we voted Remain. I think it would still have carried on. There are copies of that, only three left. There are some books. I wrote a book with Sally Tomlinson called From Brexit to the End of Empire, about what we've done. They're £10. If you any of you want a book, I'll sign them. All the money goes to this organisation so they can hold more of these meetings. We're like Texas. We're the Texas of Europe. Highest number of prisons, fastest falling life expectancy, the only country in Europe where our children are falling in height and becoming more stunted, where they are dying at a higher rate between the ages of 1 to 4 than they were a few years ago. I can reel out the most terrible sets of statistics to you, all made worse than Brexit. The poorest fifth of people here are poorer on average than the poorest fifth in Eastern Europe. We still have a better neonatal mortality rate than Romania and four other very poor countries, but ours is going to be worse than theirs within 15 years at current trends. It is falling apart. Statistically measured, it is falling apart. And it was falling apart before, which is partly why we got Brexit. We gave people only one vote in their lifetime, or two if they were old, only one democratic vote, because elections aren't democratic, first past the post isn't. We gave people one vote, and we told them, the churches, the trade unions, all the political parties, the CBI, everybody told them to vote one way. And 52% of them who voted the other way. We then misrepresented who it was that had voted. I published an article in the British Medical Journal 2 weeks after. Why the British Medical Journal? Because they fact-check it. The majority of people who voted Leave lived in the south of England, where there were a minority of the electorate. This is a southern English vote, not Stoke, not Sunderland, Hampshire. The majority of the people who voted Leave were middle class, not working class. Working class people are more likely not to vote. The majority of people who voted to leave were the people who were in the constituencies, the MPs who wanted to leave, which are Conservative constituencies. Of course they were. But we created a myth on the night of the referendum because the camera zoomed in on the first result in Sunderland. And because W1A, the BBC, could not accept the truth of their own lives, which was that if you were in that studio with, I think it was Dimbleby reporting, and you're aged in your 40s and 50s, you all knew, most of you, that although you all voted Remain because you live in West London and have dinner parties, when you go home at Christmas to Hampshire or Cornwall and Devon, your parents didn't. Now, the BBC knew that, but it was a personal, quiet, painful story, and they didn't share it around the studio. So they went on that night when they were shocked, for they were going to blame the poor, we're going to blame the northerners, we're going to blame the men, we're going to blame the unclever people. It was not. It was the affluent, old, well-off of the south of England that did this, because they were no longer that affluent. And why did they do it? I did roughly 100 public talks after the vote, all in the south, all in areas that voted Leave. They did it for their grandchildren. Right? Not selfishly, they did it because they wanted their grandchildren to have what they had had when they were young. Be able to start a home with a family in their 20s, have jobs, have an education system that was getting better, and a health service that worked. And when I asked them, the primary reason was it's for the future. Okay, there was racism, there were other things going on, but the thing I learned was that people voted Leave for hope, not for themselves, they were mainly old. It was for their children who were often renting and couldn't ever buy, and their grandchildren who they really, really were worried about. And what did they get? Heights of children falling. Right? It's a dire, terrible the pressing situation. Imagine that you're in Texas, you've left the USA, and you're trying to explain to people in Texas this was a bad idea, building a border around the edge of this, and we really ought to think of rejoining the USA. And in a sense, that's where we are now. It's not going to happen that quickly, but the very first thing we need to get straight is the story of what actually happened and who it was who voted Leave, which is easy because we've got the numbers, and then why did they vote Leave, which is a bit harder. Please come up to me afterwards and buy one of these books or the pamphlets that the very kind Germans paid to be printed, because they would like us back. They're ever so nice people. Thank you very much.
I'd like to introduce our next speaker now, Liz Webster, who's come from Wiltshire to be with us this evening. She's a farmer, and she founded Save British Farming to try and mitigate some of the effects of Brexit and to affect how the trade deals were done. She's still campaigning because work still needs to be done. And she'd like us to know about where our food comes from and how much better we'd all be if we were back trading with the EU.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. Well, first things first, just to carry on from Danny. I'm part of the monolithic bloc, the farmers, who all voted Leave. We all left House on that day, and we all voted Brexit. And I spent more time arguing with the Remainers about the fact that that is not true. The farming vote was split, as best as we know, and it depended where they lived, how old they were, what their education level was, and also which farming industry they're involved in. Because, believe it or not, farmers are not all the same. They're all different, and they do different things. So just a bit of history. I set up Farmers for a People's Vote before Brexit happened because I knew that Brexit was going to be an absolute disaster, and I knew that the sacrificial lamb of Brexit was farming and food. And largely, the Remain campaign absolutely failed, I mean total failure, to grasp the fact that the most important thing that joins us all, irrespective of your age, your background, or your education, is food. And the Leave campaign decided to jump on farming and fishing. And that's why people think that all farmers voted Brexit. And they were brilliant. Their campaign was brilliant, the Leave campaign. The Remain campaign was absolutely appalling. And they should have been talking to you and saying the things that I say over and over again to people. Because now Remainers say, huh, I don't care about those farmers. They all voted Brexit. They can reap what they sow. And my response to them every time is, look, guys, this is about your food. And you are what you eat. And if we don't have farming in this country, we're going to be in a lot of trouble because we will rely on other people to feed us. And we'll have no control over it, and we can be held to ransom. And that was always such a simple story to tell, and David Cameron and Jeremy Corbyn totally failed to deliver that simple message, which actually was positive and scary enough to make people think twice about voting Brexit, in my view. So we are where we are, together with Sean Rickard, the former NFU chief economist. We wrote a report before Brexit and we said what Brexit was going to do. And everybody said, scaremongering. We took sheep to Whitehall, we paraded them around there, we launched the report fairly late in the day. I think it was a few months before the 2019 election. But everyone said, scaremongering. And I will tell you now, it is not being scary. What has happened to food and farming has been so rapid. And that's because we didn't know that we had a COVID pandemic coming, and we didn't know about the Ukraine war. Although, I will say, many of us thought there was every chance for someone like Vladimir Putin to take advantage of Britain leaving the European Union, which is obviously why he backed it and why the Conservative Party has been so well funded in rubles. But we are at a last chance saloon now. I remember sitting with Sean after Brexit happened, and I said, well, we've got 5 years until the next election. Things are going to be a bit difficult, but agriculture is a small, it's a slow industry, you know. And I thought, well, okay, it's going to take a few years, but we'll be able to get it back. But we just didn't foresee the reality of the Ukraine war in particular, and the problems with the food chain, the supply chains coming through, which has also removed a lot of the labour force, COVID did, which meant they left so much sooner than I think they would have done, which has been cataclysmic. And so farming is in absolute crisis. We're losing a farmer to suicide every week. And that is very, very tragic. I spoke to the former NFU president last week because on Monday we are going to take our tractors to Westminster. We're not going to do anything illegal. We're just going to drive down and have a bit of a carnival and beep our horns, hopefully, and flash some lights and say, hey guys, we're just getting going. But ultimately, the reality is this: it's last chance saloon for farming. And what I need you, because I want you to do things, what I need you to do is to start helping me explain to people that farmers didn't want post-Brexit and tell them why they need to worry about their food, because it really is a problem. Everyone's distracted or scapegoating, as Danny said. And we have to get through the information war. And the reality of what's happening is, yes, farmers every week are going. Small farms are going bust, or they're getting thrown off the land. And they're talking about rewilding. And the people that are concerned with the environment go, oh, this is lovely because we can rewild everything and those farmers can't spoil everything. Where's the food going to come from if we don't produce food? And the other thing that is happening is that factory farms in Britain are increasing. And they're getting larger in size. And they're private. And you're not going to know where they are unless you fly over Britain and see them. We've got substandard food. We've got food coming in here that's illegal. First of all, that is poisonous, because we never foresaw that they would give us an unlevel playing field, where we've got trade barriers to export. And the EU exporters have had a free ride for the last 3 years, as well as the criminals who want to deliver all of their, their criminally illegal produce, which is a massive health risk for many of us, which is why foodborne illness has increased, not helped by poverty, not helped by the fact that people have no choice but to go to a pop-up illegal market and buy illegal food. All of these things are getting worse a lot quicker than we ever thought they would. And those people that really want Brexit for what they want it for, like Dominic Raab, who is member of a Facebook group which was looking forward to the days of the return of debtors' prison, the workhouse, and goodness knows what. And we have laughed over some of that, but goodness me, we are a lot closer to that than I ever thought could be possible in such a short period of time. But there is hope. We're in an election year. The Conservatives are finished.
Yes.
They're done. And we have tactical voting. We have a population who are awake. We have got some who are sort of still saying, it's not the Brexit I voted for, it's not Brexit's fault, and all of those things. But we can agree, everybody can agree, that the Conservatives have to go and that they are absolutely rotten to the core. And so I think Labour's going to win the next election. And really it's just a question of how big is that majority? And how comfortable are we of having potentially the largest majority government ever, which is a bit scary. And that's where you come in, and that's where we all come in. And that's where I'm so excited that farmers are suddenly able to get up and join us and say enough is enough. Because once those Labour MPs are in the blue wall seats, and I think it is going to be largely a lot of Labour MPs, I'm not going to go into why, once they're in those seats, they're going to be like the red wall Tory MPs, who are very, very sensitive to their inbox. And that's where we all come in, that we've got to start filling their inboxes, we've got to be organised, and we've got to make sure that we have the right arguments, which I can tell you now, first and foremost, is not to have arguments with people about what they voted in 2016 or 2019. We've got to agree that we've got to move forward and get a new voting system. We've got to get rid of the trade barriers. We've got to get rid of the substandard imports. We've got to make sure that we get a country that works. And we have to get up and make it quick, because if we don't, it's all going to collapse. And goodness knows what happens. Potentially Nigel Farage, the reform, people will turn to that in desperation. So yes, there's hope. There's still a lot to be scared of. And there's an awful lot to do. So don't think you can retire anytime soon. So on that note, I'm going to hope that you want to ask me lots of questions, because I can ramble on about farming and food forever and you'll probably all fall asleep. So I look forward to those questions and I'll pass over the microphone.
Thank you, Liz. We'll come back to you with the questions later. But first, we're going to hear from Willow Fisher. And Willow is a second year undergraduate at Manchester, and he's been involved with the Young European Movement, and he's their head of campaigns. He's come all the way from Manchester to be with us this evening. And he is an opportunity to demolish some myths. Danny was talking about older people voting for Brexit. I guess a lot of them did. But there are quite a few of us older people here tonight who very definitely didn't and feel very strongly that it shouldn't have happened. And the other myth is that young people aren't really interested in politics. Well, we've got someone here who is and who's got something to say about it all, and I hope that he's also going to tell us what we can do. Welcome, Willow.
Those are two very hard acts to follow. I want to start by just saying thank you to Oxford for Europe for having me here. It's an honour to be part of this panel, especially for being part of the first face-to-face event held in quite some time. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank Geraldine for being such a wonderful chair, and the organiser, Peter Burke. So just, can we just have a quick round of applause for the organiser? If you'd asked me 2 years ago, just before I started university, where do you think you're going to be in the middle of your second year? Being on a panel with an Oxford professor and a leading campaigner in the UK would not have been on the list I would have given you, to be honest. This came a little bit out of nowhere, my involvement in politics. I've been interested in it for a while. It was actually the Brexit vote when I was just 13 years old that really started to get me more interested, more aware of the political landscape around me. And it was only when I discovered the Young European Movement, started talking to some of the board, started talking to the president, and heard that they were thinking of running an Erasmus campaign to try to get the UK back into the Erasmus programme, that I actually really started to get involved. I was approached by the president asking if I'd like to be on the board, having already been a member of YEM. We worked together to create the Embrace Erasmus campaign, which I will tell you all about at a later point in the speech. But I think first it's important that we're all on the same page about Erasmus. obviously it's something which a lot of people know a little bit about, but in my time working with YEM, in my time campaigning, in my time making this, making the Embrace Erasmus campaign, I've discovered a lot of people have some misconceptions about Erasmus. So I thought we'll all get on the same page first of all. Probably the most important thing about it is that we didn't have to leave. Even after the Brexit vote happened, even after all of those years of going back and forth in negotiations, we were promised every step of the way that we were going to stay in Erasmus Plus. We were promised right up until just a few days before we actually left the EU, we were promised that we'd stay in. And then the government just seemed to snap reverse its decision, and suddenly we were left with nothing. We had a couple of years of funding left, but after that we were going to be completely on our own. We were making, UK universities estimated, we were making £240 million annually from the students coming over from the EU and other countries, spending their grant money, spending their money in our local economy. Of course, we were told by the government that we left Erasmus because it wasn't offering us value for money, which, you know, I'm not 100% sure about that reason myself. Erasmus offered a reciprocal exchange between countries, which our replacement, the Turing scheme, just doesn't offer. We aren't having any students come to our country from the EU. Between 2019 and 2022, we saw an 84% drop in EU students. That's just 3 years and 84%. Our universities, our young workplaces, our local organisations that were previously so enriched by these EU citizens, by these cultures that were coming over to us, not just us sending them over to the EU and other countries, but are coming over to us, just gone. Suddenly, we've lost significant amounts of soft power. We're no longer as welcoming. We aren't seen as a safe place. We aren't seen as a welcoming place for young trainees, for students, for young workers to come to anymore. It's about Erasmus, but it is broader than that, of course. When we got rid of the ability for school groups to come over to the UK without needing passports, just needing their ID cards, that hit another massive blow in youth mobility. We've been set when we left Horizon, when we left Copernicus, just putting barrier after barrier, layer of separation after separation between the UK and the EU. The UK government betrayed its students. We've betrayed our young people, our young workers, our trainees. But that's a depressing part. Out of the way, by the way. Sorry, everyone. That's the sad part over. Because things are starting to look a little bit more up. Last year, we, after a long and lengthy process, we did rejoin the Horizon scheme. We rejoined the Copernicus scheme. Our academics are back in proper contact and proper connection with the EU. We haven't done it for every country, but at least France now no longer needs passports for student groups, for young groups of people to come over to the UK. They're able to travel much more freely, and there are calls, there are increasing, growing calls from across the political spectrum for these kinds of privileges, these, you know, frankly, rights of young people in the EU to be able to come here. The calls are growing, and we're trying to get the government to expand this beyond just France, expand it to across the EU, have those rights back. Now, not enough is being done yet, and the government is staying too quiet on it. But the calls are beginning to grow. I really do firmly believe that we can do better. We can do better than the government has done in the last 5 years. I really believe there's a future for the UK that sees our young people, our students, our workers, as closely linked to the EU as ever. I'm happy to say I'm not the only one. The Young European Movement launched our Embrace Erasmus campaign. I'm sure that some of you here have heard of it, some of you might have even gotten involved in it. Some of you might not have, and that's okay. Here's your chance to learn a bit more about it. We launched it officially in December. On the same day, we launched a petition calling on the UK government to reopen negotiations to rejoin Erasmus. Our initial target was 25,000 signatures. To this day, we've had more than 41,000 in just a few months. Thank you. Which is a fantastic result considering where we were expecting to be at this point. We actually managed to hand that petition in to 10 Downing Street just about a month ago. Our campaign has had public support from Mayor Sadiq Khan, Sir Vince Cable, Caroline Lucas MP, among tons of others across the political spectrum. Amongst policymakers, amongst the people actually running the show to varying degrees, there is a common backing behind this. There is a sentiment. People want to be closer to the EU. People are starting to regret that hard break that we made between the students and the young workers of the UK and the students of young workers of the EU. The Turing scheme across the board is being seen as inadequate. Schools are crying out about how hard it is to get funding, about how tight the budget turnarounds are, about how badly handled it's been by Capita and by the private organisations that the government has decided to hand over running to. There is sentiment growing among the public, among institutions like universities, among policymakers, that we can do better. At YEM's launch roundtable, where we really launched this Embrace Erasmus programme, we hosted Alan Smith MP, Colin Markey MEP, Natalie Luiso MEP. We had people there who really are able to start making a difference. The conversation is starting to grow, and the EESC is soon to release a report on student mobility, on youth mobility, which we're expecting to massively add to the calls that already exist. Among the organisations we're partnered with, we have the British Youth Council, which is, of course, largely representative of youth organisations across the UK, and we have the Erasmus Plus Alliance, which is largely made up of people on the older side of things who have been absolutely instrumental in forming our campaign, giving us the statistics, giving us the help we needed to get it off the ground. This isn't just young people talking about this, young people like myself, young people like the body of YEM. It's not just older people talking about this. This is cross-generational. You mentioned there were some myths to dispel, but there's two of them right there. Older people and younger people have been coming together behind this issue, coming together behind this campaign to try and fight for a Europe and a UK that can be a bit closer than they are now. We're multi-generational, we're international. Our friends over at JEF, Junior European Federalists, have been active in supporting and promoting our campaign. The EU delegation to the UK has helped share our material with their society network, which have been meeting up over the last year or so, a few times over the last year or so. We've had the Erasmus Student Network and the European Student Union publicly support us. This isn't just coming from the UK. The international community wants us back in Erasmus. They recognise, just like we recognise, Turing isn't enough. Sending just our students away to countries is not enough to build up the kind of reciprocal relationships that we need. Turing doesn't offer workers or trainees anything like Erasmus does. Turing doesn't build up the relationships that Erasmus does. People are really starting to recognise what we've lost by leaving Erasmus, and the calls to rejoin are growing by the day. I don't want to end this on a naive note, necessarily. There's a lot more work to be done. The petition is still active, and if you Google Embrace Erasmus, you can find out more about the campaign, more about the work that we're doing, sign the petition. And write to an MP as well. We've had over 300 MPs written to from thousands and thousands of emails, and we are starting to actually see responses to these emails, so we know we're getting to them. It would be fantastic to see all of you help out however you can, if that means signing the petition, if it means sharing what we're doing on social media, if it means writing to your MP, anything that you can, any time you have, anything you're comfortable with, would be fantastic in just keeping this campaign going. You made a point earlier, Danny, that if this Brexit vote hadn't happened, if Brexit hadn't happened now, it would have been a long war of attrition that Brexit would have likely won in the end. It's a bit of a pessimistic outlook, but it's not one that I necessarily disagree with. Even before Brexit, there was a problem in the UK of not really seeing itself as European. We never really quite saw ourselves as connected, as integral to the European project as Germany or France did. It's why Brexit was able to happen here first. And that's why something like Erasmus is so important. Young people need to go through their lives with experiences like Erasmus, with people from the EU coming here, being able to travel freely over there, the freedom of movement, the freedom of opportunity, to understand themselves as truly being part of the European project and not just its weird neighbour off to the side, separated by about 20 miles of ocean. Things like Erasmus, Horizon, Copernicus, they are absolutely essential in integrating the UK with the EU and with Europe on the broader scale, running all through people's lives. It's why I believe so strongly that Erasmus is necessary for our student population, and why the tuition scheme just won't do. It's not enough just to send our students abroad. We need to have workers, students, trainees coming here. We need to build up those kinds of relationships. I think there's a real need for it, and I think there's a want for it. And I think we're starting, just starting, to get back to where we were. I'd like to see it keep going. I'll hand over back to Geraldine. Thank you very much.
And you mentioned your petition. Those of you who are on the mailing list for Oxford for Europe's newsletter will see that there was a link to that petition in the newsletter that I sent out last week, I think. So if you haven't signed yet, here's your opportunity. I did also mention another petition there, which is the European movement as opposed to young Europeans, to do with musicians travelling and how difficult it is now for them to do that. So do look at your newsletter. It's worth reading. So we need to move on then to you. I suggested that you think about questions, and now is your opportunity to ask one. John.
John Tanner, a member of Oxford for Europe. If we get a Labour government later this year, what three things would you like to see that Labour government do in order to knit Britain back into the European Union?
I assume everyone could hear that question. Yes. So I'm going to... Who'd like to start? Danny. You looked at me.
I see the look. It's going to be interesting because they're going to say a set of things to try and get the biggest majority, which means they're unlikely to say very much about Europe before an election, and then very probably differently afterwards. My big worry isn't what happens if Labour gets in. It's what they put in the manifesto. Because if it isn't in the manifesto, the House of Lords, which is stacked with people from the other side, including UKIP Lords, the House of Lords can change it. So it whatever you do, there needs to be a hint in the manifesto that makes things possible. Otherwise, we'll be battling against the Lords. Ironically, at the moment, the Lords are the most liberal part of government and are actually stopping some awful things happening. But don't think the Lords have suddenly become soft and so on. That's just one thing. I'll share it.
You've got two more.
You do.
So the question was, what three things would I like to I'd like to see a Labour government do to try to secure that relationship with the EU going forwards? Well, I've got a big one in mind, firstly. It would be quite nice to see commitments on Erasmus, commitments on youth mobility, on student mobility, on young workers. So I'd say that that's probably That's probably my first one. Obviously, it's the one that I've spent the most time campaigning for. It's one I've spent all my time tonight talking about, so it'd be a bit weird if I didn't mention that. That's number one. I think it's unlikely that we're going to see Labour make any steps towards a full-scale rejoin kind of commitment. What I'd prefer to see alignment between the UK and the EU. Even if we don't say we're going to adopt EU rules and regulations, one thing I'd like to see is potentially in, it's a small thing, maybe slightly niche, but make sure that a lot of our trade, our imports, and our kind of international economic policies line up well with the EU. Because I think that what a Labour government has a chance to do is, later on, if we do have a, if we do end up rejoining the EU, which we would all like to see, it'd be good to make that transition as smooth and as seamless as possible, not have to change too much, not have too much to suddenly snap, turn around on, you know, change rules, change regulations. So I'd like to see, as a second thing, an alignment of EU and UK policies on that kind of thing. And I suppose the third thing I'd like to see is less infighting among the relatively pro-European liberal political organisations, even within just the parties. I think that there needs to be united, strong fronts against the Eurosceptics, against the more conservative parties and members of Parliament. I think they need to come together, compromise where necessary, and really say, we are working together. We are not going to let the Conservatives back in. We're not going to let anything that we do get turned around. There needs to be a strong front which can consistently take us closer and closer back towards the EU.
Thank you. I'm going to take Chair's privilege here and say what I would like, just one thing, is to change the voting system. As President has to vote.
Labour have committed to a veteran agreement, and that's why I am voting Labour, because that is the first step to alignment back to Europe. It also means that they'll have to pull out of the dreadful CPTPP. It's just astonishing, isn't it? We had a vote to leave the EU, and then they've put us into the CPTPP, which is, it's got no democratic structures in it whatsoever, and you basically have to harmonise regulations with the countries that are in there. The rules are pretty much set by America, so we know what's coming. Japan is sort of holding the fort, as it were, as Trump pulls out of it. And we go in there and they say, hey guys, you've got to harmonise this and take this hormone fed beef and everything else we tell you, and we'll have no redress because of the way that the whole thing is structured. It is appalling. So I am going to be working really hard on forcing Labour's hand on CPTPP and these awful trade deals. You know, they signed a deal with Australia, which actually gave, in 15 years, it gives Australia absolute total access to our market for all, as much beef and meat as I want to send over here. But they didn't negotiate any quotas for British beef to go to Australia. Not that Australians probably are desperate to try any of our beef anyway, why would they? But it's just incredible how anyone can celebrate Brexit given what this government has done. So we need that to happen. We need to make sure that divergence is minimal, and I think that's possibly why Sunak is clinging on for as long as possible, because even though we haven't necessarily diverged per se, Europe has diverged from us because they have brought in new regulations which we have not followed. So we have to hope that that happens. I have hope that with Northern Ireland still being in the single market and the customs union but not really being in it, that there may be a fudge available with Europe and a Labour government if they've got a big majority. If we actually annihilate the Conservatives, there could be a fudge available to get rid of these trade barriers. I mean, we're not going to rejoin. We're not fit to hold office in Brussels, but at least we could get rid of those trade barriers. We could make sure that the economy could get some growth back. And we could hopefully get freedom of movement back through. You know, because Theresa May's deal was meant to be this. It was meant to be a permanent transition with a backstop for Ireland. And if I was Keir Starmer, I would go back and try and see if you could get that. As in, can we try and get back to transition without everybody really knowing about it through a fudge and get rid of these trade barriers and also stop the horrible not for EU food label, which I'm sure you've heard about, which a lot of food processors really don't want to have to go to the expense and bother of doing. So I think, again, as I'll say, I think always the biggest arguments against Brexit are food, and the biggest arguments for rejoining are with food. And I work with the Labour Party, and I remind them, and I remind Shadow Farming Minister, that no government, irrespective of the size of their majority, survives food crises.
So, more questions. The lady at the back, in red. Willow, would you like to speak first? Could you repeat the question?
So, for those who didn't hear, a point was made that people from my generation are among the most unhappy generations since it started being recorded. We're not doing too good, and with that, in light of that, are we ready to vote? Was that it?
Yes.
It's a tricky question. It is true, firstly, that people in my generation are more depressed, they're more anxious, they're more uncertain than most generations are at my age, particularly those living in peacetime. It's a bit of a depressing statistic to look at. And if this was all just cultural, if this was all just access to internet, social media, which don't get me wrong, it's done its fair share in making us more anxious, but if it was all just access to social media, peer pressure, etc., causing people my age to be generally sadder, then yeah, I do think that we would be seeing a little bit of a problem in voting, a problem in political apathy. But it's not just that. Material conditions are getting tougher. My generation has come of age during a COVID pandemic, during a major European war, during a cost of living crisis, during a time of major political instability. These aren't just, intra-generational cultural factors. We're sad and miserable and anxious for some pretty good reasons, and some pretty good reasons related to the politics of this country. Most of the young people that I know are at least politically aware, if not politically active. I study in Manchester myself, and it seems like every other day there is a march of young people running up and down the Oxford Road, getting in the way of my bicycle, which is heartening to see. If a little bit annoying sometimes. I know so many people who study PPE like me and don't, getting involved in political campaigns, getting involved in activism, getting involved in fundraising, it's not always just about EU stuff. Recently it's been related to Palestine, for example. A lot of it's about women's rights. That's quite a big thing in Manchester. But young people, people my age, they really are politically active. They really are politically aware. This isn't an apathetic generation. The question of whether they're going to vote is a question of whether major political parties are going to tap into that political energy. I can't guarantee they're going to vote. I can guarantee they're going to care.
Good. And Liz, question for you about the NFU.
The NFU, yes. Well, the NFU's got a new president, Tom Bradshaw, who actually used to be part of our campaign group before he was elected. So I do know that he agrees with me about Brexit wholeheartedly. My personal view about Gwyneth Paltrow is that she's a very good speaker, and she's very, you know, I think farmers have been proud of her as the person to represent them. But, you know, I will never forgive her for smiling across the table for Boris Johnson and sending him that love letter, and capitulating on the Agriculture Act, which is what has got us into the mess that we're in. And largely, she just commentated on what has happened. And I'm sure that the other people could have done the same. She should have been fighting and resisting it, and she hasn't. The truth of the matter is, the biggest landowners in the country have got a lot more weight than us smaller farmers. And they're trying to keep it together. But they are really scared of our protests. And it's interesting that the protest, you know, we know in Wales there's something going on with, and they're coming out about trying to blame Labour for net zero, which is the same thing that happened in Hounslow with the, ULEZ thing. And it's a false direction. So the dissent has really begun in Kent, which is where Brexit began with Nigel Farage. And the farmers there have started out by going out to the Port of Dover, and then they did another thing which didn't work. They spoke to me, I said, just do a rally, don't do anything obstructive. And they had a fantastic rally in Canterbury, 240 tractors turned up. And on Monday, you know, we've got, I don't know how many, it's raining, so it means we're going to have more tractors. We'll see how many turn up, and it might be a bit chaotic. But that is going to make the NFU move, and that's what's relevant to us here today, no matter what our age, is that we are too quiet and too accepting of British people. I'm actually Welsh, so that's why I'm Corby and feisty. But I also grew up under Thatcher, and that was really bad, but we have punk rock, thank God. So, we have to stop putting up and keeping calm and keeping quiet. And I think it will be easier with a Labour government because there is this degree of fear for Conservatives. I've seen Starmer cower back from Boris Johnson in particular because of the exceptionalism. And that's what happens between someone that's gone to Eton and Oxford and somebody that's not had such a privileged education, because what that privileged education gives you is confidence. So on the NFU, sorry, I've done it a bit here. On the NFU, I think we will see some change. They are meeting with us, they've agreed to meet with us. Minette refused to meet with us as a campaign. So there is change, but I think they're very tied to the corporations, it'll be a slow, slow process. But I think as farmers rise up and do more, they're going to have to respond. And Labour, I have got the door open to me. You know, I don't know if I don't, I've got it on WhatsApp. There's absolutely nowhere I've got a Tory on WhatsApp. So that is progress.
Nice to see so many hands up. The lady here.
My name is Jenny Mollahan, and I was the founder with the architect of Erasmus, of the alliance, which initially started to fight at the time when the young European movement was not very active, and it was a hell of an uphill battle. But it was Howard Jones, who is a Welshman, who phoned me and said, "We can't let this happen, Jane, can we?" And I said, "No, we can't." And so we got together a bunch of marvellous people who've been professionals in Erasmus. They were teachers, trainers, people who worked in every walk of life.
Just to say, we don't have a lot of time. And would you move on to your question, please?
Now is, the twofold. One is, in Europe, they want us back. They've said so constantly. There was a committee in the autumn which pointed out that the body that has been formed in order to negotiate the trade agreement in 2005 had no young people on it. I'm wondering whether, Willow, you and your and Riem are now being part or aiming to be part of that group. That's one question. The second, quickly, is that many people who are pro-Erasmus in Labour don't know anything about it. They think it's all to do with students, and they don't know anything about a very, very large part, in fact, a major part of funding, which is for non-students. I'm wondering how much you're able to convince Labour that it's the best levelling up ladder that exists.
So the question is about Erasmus and how Labour can be encouraged to support it more and how young people can get involved in fighting for it.
Yes, so to answer your first question, there actually have been some conversations about that recently. While there's been no like official offers, we've been talking about this with the EU delegation and some representatives from the EU delegation, as well as people that work in both the British Youth Council and the EESC about ways that organisations such as and including EM can get more involved in taking, you know, in being consulted on this kind of thing, in taking potentially advisory positions, in having some kind of influence on this element of politics. So yes, I can give some good news there. In fact, the EESC is going to be releasing a report pretty soon, headed by a man called Maurizio, a representative of the British Youth Council as well, which is going to be about student mobility and youth mobility broadly. So yes, I can say that young people are starting to have more of an active hand in that. Secondly, I completely agree with you. A lot of people, not just in Labour, but also in Labour, do generally think that Erasmus is, it's just that thing that university students do for a couple months. It's a lot broader than that. It's got young workers in it, has school groups, it has trainees, many groups which a Turing scheme actually does not offer. The Turing scheme is pretty explicitly focused on just students and has kind of hijacked the general conversation by putting the focus on just students. So a lot of people think of Erasmus and Turing as functionally the same thing. Maybe they know that Turing doesn't let other people over to the UK, but that's about all they know. So part of convincing policymakers that Erasmus is necessary and we do need it back is breaking that kind of narrative. It's not just talking about students, it's actively talking about the trainees, the workers who've been let down by this, the local organisations who don't step foot on the mainland but still used to get Erasmus funding. The British Youth Council had about 40% of their funding covered by the Erasmus programme, despite having no activities in Europe, really, and so were left a bit high and dry when we left the Erasmus programme. So it is about breaking that narrative and talking more openly about the different non-student related benefits of Erasmus.
Thank you. More questions? Good. Well, it's nice to see a lot of hands up as we get towards the end, because I'm not sure if we're going to have time for many more. Can I ask for your question? Yes, John.
Yes, is there also work that we need to do here, Britain, apart from campaigning to join the EU, which prepares us for it? I mean, I've worked in Ukraine, and they say they want to join the EU, but the EU says, yeah, you've got to tackle things in your country, like corruption. Now, corruption seems to have grown and grown here in Britain. I don't know how it compares with other countries in the EU, but we see staggering examples of it. Is the work that we who want to rejoin have to do here to make us ready to rejoin?
So the question for those who didn't hear is there work that needs to be done in this country to get Britain ready to rejoin? Not just a matter of voting to rejoin, but all the work that needs to be done. For instance, in Ukraine, who want to join, they're working hard on trying to get rid of corruption. Danny, can I ask you to have a go at that?
Rejoining fast is difficult. A sudden massive crisis in an emergency. If we rejoin, we have to join the euro. Yeah, that's which I'd be happy with. But you have to begin to think, what do we have to plan to do that? So it's a lot of work, which is why people talk about aligning, thinking about being like Norway and Switzerland first, and starting with young people. So I should say, when I wanted to say one thing about Erasmus, my 35-year career in universities in Britain has been completely altered by young academic staff, everybody younger than me, always seeming to have been an Erasmus student before they became a lecturer. I joined that college next door. I grew up in this city thinking they're going to be a bit stuffy. I walk into my first governing body meeting in St. Peter's, and a third of the governing body are from the mainland of Europe. You know, we just have no idea how much this country was altered by the integration, which makes an Oxford University College work, because that's the young third of the governing body. And they can speak other languages and think in different ways and don't all have a first degree from Oxford, which is kind of like spiralling down to the bottom, if that's what we used to do. But it's... I don't know how truthful to be. You know, do we tell people, we walked out of an incredible deal where we didn't pay our fair way, we were allowed to have our own currency, we had this migration of people who other countries had paid for their education and their childbirth and everything, and then their most skilled came over here and worked for a pittance and lived in the worst housing they'd ever lived in their lives, lowest quality housing, for the excitement of being in England. And I think it's probably not a good idea to dwell on the past and what we lost, because it's kind of like too bad. But we have to realise we are going to go back in one day as a normal small country trying to agree accession. And the question is, will it be us or Turkey first? It's probably going to be Turkey first. Yeah, but let's not, you know, work that out. We've got to do it in a way that works. The only fast way back in is a sterling crisis, an emergency. The currency is no longer worth having, and. You know, if you like a saving of the UK by you're back in immediately, but bang, the currency changes that year. Very unlikely, but we've had this series of crises in the last 20 years, which you would have said were very unlikely. So fast things happen in that case. I won't speculate any more about it, but that is the way in which I think we'd be most likely to join fast. Would be if we had a problem with sterling. If somebody plays a game, we don't make our steel anymore. If somebody plays a game with this currency, you know, actually bets against the UK, how will sterling hold up, given that we're already paying the highest fee for borrowing money from abroad, because we are seen as the most dodgy, weakest, perilous, badly managed country by international bankers. So we have to be careful about it. I'm only being this down because I know you lot want largely to be back in the EU, but the situation is pretty dire, made worse by Brexit, covered up by a pandemic, so you couldn't immediately say that was Brexit. But as the pandemic was our life expectancy still isn't back to 2014. Every other European country is better. You know, our standard of living, our real wages are not back up to 2008. You go to Amsterdam, it's a bit of a shock because they've carried on getting better off. And it's tricky, if you're British, to go over to the mainland and actually see what normal, relatively slow growth means. Just what people look like, what clothes they're wearing, the heights they are at. You know, and that's going to be, and you can see the resentment. So I'm not quite sure how to play it. I don't know how much do you say about what has happened, because you're up against patriotism and pride and talking the country down. And that's difficult in these circumstances.
There's a gentleman at the back who's had his hand up for a long time. Can you shout, please?
My name is Joe Hart. I'm also from the Labour Party. I'm also a farming background. No one has to panel what they shared about the consequence of COVID and Ukraine, the concentration of profits in the energy and supermarket retail sector. These two areas have enormous profits. Both things should be taxed, excess profits tax, to get us back up to speed with Europe on decarbonising the problem.
I think I've got the gist of what you're saying, and yes, I understand that the profiteering for supermarkets, Sainsbury's and Asda actually are the most benefited most from this series of shocks. On the energy side, I'm not a Ukraine war specialist, but we know that most of the corn price has dropped because we've got so much corn coming in from Ukraine, and it makes you feel upside down because it doesn't really make any sense. There is a lecture, actually, from the Oxford Martin School from 2012. Dr. Martin talks about how we're going to have 100 years of chaos and how the real beneficiaries will be the big corporations, and the four big superpowers will emerge. Russia, United States, China, and India. And I often go back to that lecture, and he talks a lot about factories, lab-grown meat, change to the food system, and then gosh, they're funded by some of the tech billionaires like Peter Thiel and so forth, and there is a lot of that is happening, and you're thinking, well, how did you know that in 2012 that this is what was going to happen? But the chaos and the shocks are ensuring that more money is filtering into fewer hands, and the corporations are getting so much more power, and that feeds into CPTPP, because that's exactly what CPTPP is designed for, so that if a government legislates something which punishes or penalises a corporation, the corporation can sue the national government. And it brings us back probably to William Rees-Mogg's book, The Sovereign Individual, which is, I guess, their book now. It sounds like conspiracy theory, it's scary, and it is happening, and I hope we can stop it.
We've got time for one more question, but it's got to be a very short one. Could you ask it?
I'm going to ask an extremely short question, okay? Yes, I am. If people had to vote in this country, I'm Australian, if people had to vote in this country, what do we think that would do? Do we think we would have been here, and do we think we'd have the society we have? Because when everyone has to vote, everyone talks about politics, and you don't get people who just care who you're in.
Thank you. So you are saying, if it was actually the law that you had to vote, would it make a difference?
Well, it was a short question. I had two.
And short answers, please.
Well, Just to clarify, I do believe it is the law in Australia, right, that you have to be at the, you have to be at the, or the law somewhere, but you have to put a piece of paper in, but you can spoil it, or you can leave it.
You have to turn up.
So yeah, exactly.
The culture is that you vote, you have responsibilities
to vote. And I think that's, I think that's fantastic. I think it's a really good idea. I think that it should be, ideally, the voting day should be a national holiday as well, to guarantee that as many people can be out at the ballot box as it possibly can be. But yes, I do think that if everybody had a responsibility to be there, be at the ballot box, even if you literally hated every party and you just scribbled like a big X on the piece of paper and put it in, or if you spoiled your vote somehow, then it obviously wouldn't get counted. But I do think that if we had an expectation and a responsibility, really, to be there on the day, to actually vote, I think it would do two things. Firstly, I think that it would encourage people largely to maybe get a bit more acquainted with politics. They're going to have to take the day out anyway. They might as well know like what they're voting for. You know, it's a bit, if you're there to spoil a ballot, you might as well be there to put a real vote in. So I do think that people would generally try to educate themselves a bit more on politics. But I think the real major thing it would do is that it would prevent any kind of direct or, which is more common, indirect voter suppression. People who work long hours during the day, people who can't afford childcare, people who have to be constantly either working or looking after their kids, poorer people, they are some of the least likely to vote. Not because they don't care, but just because a lot of them can't spare the time. A lot of them have to work that day. Or a lot of them have to, you know, they don't have the time to research it properly in their own spare time. And these, and like you said earlier, we've been fed a narrative that, like, in recent years, they, you know, poorer people, people who spend more time a day working, they've all just randomly turned conservative and bigoted. And it's not true at all, as you said. If these groups had better access to voting, if they didn't have the barriers in place or which exist right now, I think that we would probably see a society which trends more towards caring, more towards the drive towards, you know, more towards interconnectedness than we see now, both because of increased education and because of the increased increased ability and necessary ability to vote that a policy like that would bring.
Thank you.
I would push more on the change of the voting system, not worrying about what it was to, but something that's much more PR, so people have got something to vote for that they believe in. Because those countries do better, which have that, and many in Europe have had it for 100 years. What I would do is give people a vote in national elections at 16. And one of the reasons, well, it makes it, it's an event, you know, are you not going to vote when you're 19? When the 16-year-olds can vote, you go and vote. It's a one-off. But we have the highest health inequalities now in Europe, which means the better off third of the population get to vote in one or two more elections in their lifetime. The pro-conservative bias of life expectancy is about 5 to 7% swing because you get to vote more times because you live longer. At least letting people vote at 16 reduces that a bit. What ultimately you want is a normal European country where you don't have these big differences, you don't have these 10 or 20 year gaps in the average life expectancy between neighbourhoods. I mean, it's incredibly unfair. You could be really mean and say you can only vote in 10 general elections and one referendum in your life. That would have solved it, by the way. But I think that's not very fair.
I'm definitely all for changing the voting system. I do really strongly believe that we should teach politics in schools. I was lucky in that I was privately educated. I went to an Irish conference from a young age, and they definitely gave me the idea of politics. And then I went to a liberal boarding school, and we were encouraged to be politically active, but my family were politically active as well. But I think I'm unusual. We need to make sure that people are more politically active. We also need some restraints on the media, particularly the Australian man, family, Murdoch, who's getting married again for the sixth time, I think.
because he's been controlling the elections. It's the son what won it, you know. And I really do believe that. No, he's an American. He emanated from over there. I'm blaming you for it. that needs to change. But that's why I say this is last chance to lose. We've got the opportunity to get rid of the Conservatives. And God, you know, for the first time, I've been living in a blue wall seat with a horrible rancid Tory MP. And my vote has never counted. In the Brexit referendum, my vote didn't count because I voted Remain. And to get rid of that, will be a revolution. We kid ourselves to think that we've got democracy at the moment. It's faux democracy. And we really must unite behind that, and it is urgent to get that sorted. So let's hope we do move Labour and work hard together and stop looking back at what people voted before and say, let's get the young involved up on the streets. And when we do get into protesting, and this is probably a controversial point, we need to think about how we attract a new swell of people onto the streets. And sometimes going out, we love all our blue stuff, and that perhaps we need a rebrand, you know. We did sort of have that with People's Vote, I believe. But we need something larger. To get the changes we need millions and millions on the streets.
The revolution starts here.
Yes.
Thank you very much to our three speakers who have given us a lot to think about, and we're very grateful to them for having come here, and I'd like you all to thank them.